The Florida Orchestra is entering its 48th season with a new music director, and he is our Florida Matters newsmaker this week, Michael Francis.
Support for Florida Matters comes from the Hospitals of BayCare Health System, providing more than 100 health seminars, classes, and events each month. BayCare's mission is to build a healthier Tampa Bay. Register for a complimentary health seminar, class, or event at baycareevents.org.
From the Donna Studio at WSF Public Media, I'm Carson Cooper. In recent years, Michael Francis has gained a reputation as an international conductor, having been at the helm of major orchestras across North America, Asia, and Europe. So, Michael Francis, welcome to Florida Matters. That must have been one heck of an offer to bring you to Tampa.
Well, thank you, Carson. It's a pleasure to be here. Well, Florida Orchestra was such an appealing place to come. As soon as I came and did my first rehearsal here, I felt very much at home with the musicians. There was a great attitude, and the staff were terrific. There's a tremendous sense of ambition, and I really felt the whole area was very exciting.
Now, you're a named music director last year, did three concerts with the Florida Orchestra, but this is your first full season?
That's correct. Actually, I mean, it was three projects. So in essence, it was nine concerts. But I also did quite a few concerts in hospitals and in malls as well. So it was a reasonably busy time as the music director designate. But yes, I am now starting.
Now, I want to talk about this current season in just a moment. But first of all, and this is kind of comes from a radio perspective, when a radio station gets a new program director, and I've been there many times, all the disc jockeys get really nervous thinking, uh-oh, this is it, I'm toast. Now, were the musicians at the Florida Orchestra kind of looking at you with a degree of suspicion?
Well, you'll have to ask them. I hope to think that I'm a reasonably nice one because I was an orchestral player myself. So I understand the pressure of what they do on the day-to-day level. But yes, I suppose I did hear someone mention the new sheriff is in town. So everybody is, they are always a little bit more on alert, but not in a way that they feel threatened, but hopefully in the way that they just want to do their very best, as I do.
Mm-hmm. Now, you are the orchestra's fourth music director, following Erwin Hoffman, Yaqia Ling, Stefan Sanderling. Did you have any relationships with those?
No, I didn't. I haven't met Stefan yet. I did meet Yaqia when I went to San Diego, where I'm also music director of the Mainly Mozart Festival, and he is music director of the San Diego Symphony. So we enjoyed a very nice lunch together, and we spoke about the Florida Orchestra and what he loved about it, where he lived, and all the different things.
At that point, did you know you're heading for Tampa Bay?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Are music directors typically a pretty tight-knit bunch?
Well, the problem with us is that we tend to be slightly lone wolves, is that sort of we never really see each other. So you always have one conductor in any city at one point or with any orchestra. So sort of every Sunday or Monday, depending on when the week finishes, we all jump on planes and travel around. So we rarely bump into each other, actually.
Yeah. I imagine that you don't like to be compared to your predecessors, but what do you bring to the podium in Tampa Bay that's different?
Well, I think every conductor has a very unique angle, and every conductor has a very unique repertoire and style. I would say that I'm looking to bring a season that is very integrated, so that people really feel a journey through the season. I have a very wide repertoire of music, and I would also say that I'm looking to really take us out into the community as well in a much more engaged and proactive manner. Those would be the first things that I'm looking to do. And of course, with any music director, we're always looking to develop the orchestra in a way that creates a stylistic flexibility so that they have a tremendous quality of sound, which is also flexible to each of the composer's demands.
Mm-hmm. I heard you say that you learned how to conduct an orchestra by joining one. You pointed out you're a musician as well. So you got a gig with the London Symphony Orchestra. What surprised you? First of all, that was probably no easy feat. You're just getting into the orchestra. But what surprised you most when you got inside the mind of a conductor as a musician?
Yes, well, I wanted to be a conductor before that, but I felt the best way for me to learn was to join the best orchestra I could, and I was fortunate enough to get into the LSO. What was great for me was I got a chance to speak with these conductors. I got to know them. So Sir Colin Davis, Valery Gergiev, Bernard Haitink, Daniel Harding and John Elliott Gardner, all sorts of different conductors. I would chat with them, discover different things. But I would say even above that, the most useful thing I learned was from listening to the players. Because what was amazing is in one concert, you could have the wind section not like a conductor, but the strings adore him. And then equally within the string section, you could have one person on a desk who sort of has OCD tendencies sitting next to somebody who loves spontaneity. They're never going to like the same conductor. Mm-hmm. So there was a whole strata of different, opinions that I learned, and also the psychology of how rehearsals work. And it's amazing how an orchestra can feel suddenly very nervous with a conductor or suddenly very confident. And it's sort of an unwritten, unspoken thing. So I felt there was a lot I learned sort of in between the notes as such.
So you're sitting in an orchestra as a musician, double bass, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And are you thinking all the while, this is just a temporary stop for me, I'm going to be on that podium someday? Or did you sort of, you know, think maybe you were going to pursue the life of a musician at that point?
I always knew I was going to leave.
Always knew.
Yeah, and they knew it as well. And then, of course, I was very fortunate when I was in the orchestra that I got many opportunities to conduct.
When you played in the orchestra, what were the biggest things a conductor would do that would just tee you off, that you probably said to yourself, I'll never do that when I'm up there?
I would say there are many things, and what's interesting is what may tee you off with one conductor, you'll love in another. So, for example, some conductors may love to talk an awful lot in rehearsal, and it may be irritating from one person, but the other person may be fascinating and you're dying to hear everything they say. Some conductors may love everything huge and loud, and you think that's really brash, but then another conductor comes along, and the same thing sounds incredibly exciting. So it's rather difficult to sort of describe what makes something irritating for a musician, because it's really dependent on the personality of the conductor.
Mm. Are you a talker during rehearsals?
I think I am to an extent. I mean, I think musicians do want to hear the conductor's opinion. I mean, of course, the fundamental thing is to show it, because in the concert, you will be showing it. So your body language, your gestures, your eyes, your everything you do. But equally, the use of metaphor to describe something. So if you want to get a reaction from the musicians, when they're high-quality musicians like they are here in the Florida Orchestra, they don't need to be told how to play things technically.
Mm-hmm.
Occasionally, I mean, so then you would offer them a metaphor or sort of a vision about where this section of the music is in comparison to the rest of the piece.
Yeah.
And by offering them that, they will then fill in the gaps themselves.
I wonder, now, I know conductors are different, each one, but generally speaking, are conductors tough for a musician to approach with a problem or a complaint?
Not anymore. I think that changed. I think conductors used to be that way. I mean, if we think back to the great maestro of Toscanini or Stokowski or even George Sal and Fritz Reiner, it was a different time where the conductor was very much a dictator. And, of course, it oscillated very much now the other way, where musicians have a huge amount of power. And quite rightly so. I think musicians were very badly treated by these conductors. But nowadays, it's much more collegiate and much more friendly and much more interactive between the musicians and the conductor.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've probably heard this 1,000 times. You're a young guy. We're 39 and counting at this
That's
point.
Right, yes. I'm closing in on 40.
So you came of age in Great Britain in the 80s. So how did you escape the musical throes of Dexy's Midnight Runners and Wham? I mean, what were you into back in those days?
Well, Wham was just a little before me. I mean, I suppose there was Adam and the Ants was my first thing when I was about 4 or 5. Where apparently my mother saw me with a tie tied around my head and a little bit of her lipstick on my cheeks to try and look like this rather rock and roll guy. And then apart from that, I mean, I really liked U2. And then there was a style of music that came out in the 90s called acid jazz, artists like Jamiroquai and Corduroy and this. And I really enjoyed that music when I was at university.
What was the last rock concert you went to?
Oh, gosh, now you've really caught me out. I went and saw a gentleman play actually here in Tampa, and I've forgotten his name. It might be Ed Sheeran, but maybe not. My wife will tell me. She wanted us to go. I've forgotten his name.
Oh, okay.
But he was good. The only thing I found is that it's just so unbearably loud. And I suppose I'm very protective of my ears now, so I was probably looking awfully uncool with huge bits of tissue paper stuffed in my ears.
My guest is Florida Orchestra conductor Michael Francis here on Florida Matters. Have you always been a classical music fan?
Yes, I mean, I didn't start music till quite late for children, actually. I was about 10 or 11 with the double bass. And before that, I was a huge sports nut, and I still am. Really, once I started with it, I really just fell in love with it very much.
What hooked you on it?
I think just the sheer power and variety and the depth of emotion and the excitement of playing it as well. The physicality of making sound, working with your friends, and feeling something develop from the first rehearsal to the concert was something very, just so engaging and so exciting and such a visceral experience for a young musician. Mm-hmm. And within 6 months of playing, because my father was my teacher, so I was able to advance quite quickly. I was on a tour of the time in 1989 in communist sort of Hungary, playing Tchaikovsky's Fourth Symphony. And that sweep of an orchestra, it's just, it's hairs on the back of the neck stuff when you're a child. And that really hooked me. So I sort of became a little bit of a record nerd. I'd go around to the charity shops where the thrift shops, I think you call them here, and just buy all the records that were on sale. So I sort of amassed a very large collection and would love to listen to them. And the funny thing, of course, about having a record collection is when I hear certain pieces now, I get to a certain point in the piece and I half expect it to skip, like the record I know.
I've got songs I hear the 8-track changing tracks.
Yeah, exactly.
Same thing, you expect that. Now, the one thing that hooked me to classical music, and if you don't mind a shameless plug here for our classical radio station here, WSMR 89.1 and 103.9, I was hooked by a piece I heard on the radio. I think it was a Ravel piece, and I actually called the radio station and asked what that piece was. So there are really a number of ways that people get drawn into classical music, hearing it on the radio, maybe hearing it in a movie or on a television show.
I think all those are absolutely valid and excellent ways. And of course, I mean, I happen to believe that hearing a live orchestra is the most magnetic way for people to really experience the joy of classical music, to watch the kinetic power of everybody moving their bows together, to see that sense of camaraderie, almost like a micro society of in the way an orchestra works. And that is, for children, a really powerful experience to see that.
Now, you are, as we pointed out, a musician yourself, double bass, and I got to think that you can't be a good conductor unless you are a musician. Is that true?
Well, of some description. I mean, I don't think you have to be an orchestral musician. Many great conductors, Herbert von Karajan, for one, was a pianist. So I think you do need to have musical training for sure. And you do need to have an understanding of how the orchestral instruments work. There isn't one instrument you need to play to be a conductor. I think it helps if you have played in orchestra, but it really isn't necessary.
Now, you make your living waving your arms at, at musicians to draw out their best abilities. You got to miss that yourself at some level. You got to miss that high of being a musician, playing the music.
Yes, I mean, there is a physicality to playing the double bass which is really joyous. So something like Mahler's Second Symphony, Beethoven's Third Symphony, the joy of playing is amazing. However, the joy of conducting for me is far greater. Because even though I don't make a noise, and if I move my arm now, of course, on radio, you can't see it. But the point is, you can't hear it. And everything is produced by other people. And so my instrument is not a violinist or a double bassist. It's a person. So I have to sort of find a way to connect with that person and bring out the best in that individual person. Mm-hmm. And that's the great joy of it. So for conducting, you may not have the physicality of the sound, but of course I'm trying to get the sound in my hands all the time just by the resistance of my movement. So if I'm looking to get a drum hit, I might be very quick and flicky. But if I'm trying to get a string sound, it's a deep movement with lots of resistance in my arm. So actually I am mimicking sound, and that's really one of the great arts of conducting so that when a musician sees what you're doing, they automatically can interpret that into their technical ability to make the sound.
And that's a strenuous job. I notice you're wearing looks like a watch. It's a health monitor, right?
It's an Apple Watch, yes. Uh-huh. I have to admit, being the slight Apple geek for it. But yeah, I mean, I was interested. I only bought it recently, and I thought I'd wear it in rehearsals. And I was quite pleased to see how many calories I burnt conducting. There was a book, I think, came out, Exercise Like a Conductor and Live Till Vast Old Age or something. I don't know the title. But because conductors have their arms typically high up, it sort of increases the blood pressure into the heart in a good way, and it's very aerobic. So, and conductors do seem to reach their peak between the ages of 60 and 80. So it hopefully has a reasonable longevity.
My guest is Florida Orchestra Music Director Michael Francis. The orchestra's 48th season is underway, and you can see the schedule at WUSFnews.org. Click on the Florida Matters link. We're going to talk about the alleged demise of classical music in just a moment as we return. I'm Carson Cooper. This is Florida Matters. This is Florida Matters. I'm Carson Cooper. The Florida Orchestra has begun its new season with a new music director. Michael Francis is my guest for this Florida Matters Newsmaker special. Now, we've heard reports, and we've heard these for years and years, about the demise of classical music for decades. But every article that I read about this, about aging audiences and lagging box office sales, supporters say it's just not true. They point out that the Chicago Symphony recently received $32 million in gifts, ticket sales at Indianapolis up 19%. Florida Orchestra attendance has been way up in recent years. So honest to God truth, no spin here. Are orchestras as a whole doing great? Are they doing kind of great? Or are they on life support?
I would say, honestly, it depends on the city you're in. And I think it depends on the economic health of that city. Some places, are the orchestras are almost in palliative care, where they are struggling to maintain what was once a previous glory. And the type of funding where maybe one lovely old widow would leave 50, 60 million. That times have changed because the billionaires are now often kids in Palo Alto. So it has changed in that sense. But no, I do not think for one second that classical music is on the decline. And I look at here in Florida, we now have the Classical Kids Program. So we're giving free tickets to children between the age of 5 and 18, as long as they have a paying adult with them, to come to our concerts. And our ticket sales are up each year, and we're making our numbers, and we're growing, and we're looking to be really one of the best and fast-growing orchestras in America. So I would say that it depends where you are. I think Florida, we're in a very fortunate situation. We're now the third biggest state. We're in a period of great growth, and I think everybody wants to live here, and quite rightly so. So I would say, no, I don't think that is a problem. Now, you did mention one thing about aging audiences, and that's an important issue. The aging audience is only prevalent because they have more disposable income and time. The children have left the nest. And those sort of in the 30s and 40s, who we often don't see quite as much in audiences, are raising children. And as myself with a child now, I know how difficult that can be. But in the big cities I played when I was in London, we had a tremendous amount of people in their 20s, and it became a really good date night. I think orchestras like Cleveland are very good at making people aware that actually a concert is a wonderful date night. And when people realize that, the shared experience of listening together, watching it, and conversing about it, and unlike in a cinema, you have an interval, you have more time to talk about it. I think that classical music is really alive and healthy.
The Atlanta Symphony Orchestra has had labor troubles in recent years. Other orchestras have also had issues between labor and management. Why does this keep happening?
I think that's also its previous models, which are not always able to sustain through. So if an orchestra can, and I'm not speaking at all about these orchestras individually, but if there have been a situation where a previous type of endowment or a previous type of giving has always been in place, and then just because the way it's shifted with who the millionaires and billionaires are today, if they have the old model, then they can get themselves into trouble. Mm-hmm. So musicians have had to become very flexible and realize that it's not the same. They can't just turn up and play masterworks concerts all the time. And the orchestras who survive and grow are the ones like the TFO, because what we're looking to do is say, actually, yes, the heart of what we do happens in the concert hall, but we will also come out to you and we will change that entire process and we will engage with you in a much more dynamic, interesting and caring way.
When an orchestra is heavy on masterworks, this appeals more to the musicians and music purists, true?
Yes, but it's also the very heart of what we do, because without that, of course, an orchestra cannot grow artistically. So the music of the great masters is the absolute epicenter of what we do. But of course, with that, it must be new composers, fresh music being written today as well. And then from that, then we can branch out with the pops music, which of course is so important, and then moving into other areas as well.
Symphony consultant Daryl Edwards has said orchestras need to diversify and include more pop music in order to sell more tickets. Now, are pops performances, are they a necessary evil among many orchestras? Do the musicians like them?
And I wouldn't call them an evil. I mean, I feel so strongly in them that my second week here in Florida is going to be conducting a pops concert myself, a night at the Oscars. So that shows how much I care about it. I mean, the London Symphony Orchestra, where I was of course the most famous film orchestra. So I happen to have played on all these films, a lot of these films. Well, not the ones from the 1940s. I'm not that old. so I think pops music, it's just a way of really making people still hear live music. There's no good or bad music. And I think what's really interesting here in Florida is how successful our coffee concerts are. So this is a more diverse repertoire performed at 11 o'clock in the morning. But we have an incredible audience, and we're growing year on year with that. So that's a sort of form of diversification in terms of when the concert is presented. But actually, by doing that, you're capturing a far wider and more reflective demographic of the community.
Do you measure the cultural health of a community by its support of an orchestra?
To an extent, yes.
Is the orchestra the catalyst for a healthy arts scene, or does the community already have to be a vibrant arts community before an orchestra dares to give it a try?
An orchestra is really wonderfully placed within any community because it can do things that no other arts institution can. It can tour to smaller places, larger places. It can go into a hospital. And here in Tampa Bay, we have a unique situation. It's a tremendous amount of great museums here. And I think what's encouraging is that even during the recession from 2008, they still built many museums. So the desire for art here is clearly prevalent and clearly healthy. But every week we play Tampa, St. Petersburg, and Clearwater. So we literally bridge the community together. And that's something very, very powerful. So I believe that an orchestra should be one of the great cultural leaders and not just reactors to the economic situation, but really proactively changing it and growing it. I've just been in San Diego, and we were doing a thing called Mozart and the Mind, which was a symposium based around Mozart's prodigy years. And we had all sorts of scientific speakers come. And what was really amazing was they were saying categorically that children who play music will go on to have better mental health, better physical skills, better kinetic skills. And what's even more interesting is that even if they play music and stop playing it, they still get the benefits into later life with increased hearing, better hearing, and less hearing loss. So the proof now of music's benefit to society, to education, to togetherness, to community, is coming out increasingly so all the time. So we mustn't ever believe it to be frivolous entertainment, but it's something so endemically important to everything we do. It is intrinsic to a healthy community. And the orchestra should be the absolute forefront of cultural leadership.
So if my kids are listening, keep up on those piano lessons, please.
Please do. So, and someone described it as a bit like compound interest. You make the investment early and you reap the benefits later on.
Are you still with Sweden's Norrköping, if I said that right, symphony orchestra?
You said it perfectly. Yes, I am. I'm in my last season now.
You are known for bringing to audiences there the great romantic composers, Beethoven, Mahler, but also many 20th century works, if you've already suggested here, and particularly focusing on Swedish and Nordic music.
Yes, I believe that a music director has to have a large repertoire because you want your audience to have a balanced diet. I don't feel I can just specialize in one type. I really want to present a wide variety to the audiences.
How do you gauge what audiences want in a particular market?
That's, first of all, a lot of discussion with the existing staff to really and really talk to the musicians, talk to the staff. But then I think what I found interesting in Norrköping, and this is where I learned how to do this, is that they start to trust you. So, for example, some of the most important concerts we did in my first season were, one piece was by Peter Maxwell Davis, the contemporary British composer, called Eight Songs for a Mad King. This piece is crazy. The singer is screaming, shouting. It's completely atonal. The audience gave a wild standing ovation. And another piece we did by a British composer called James Macmillan, Confessions of Isabel Gowdy, again successful. Now, I did actually communicate a little bit before each piece, but the audience loved it so much that in future seasons, even when they didn't recognize the composer on the program, they trusted my choice. They trusted my judgment. And so what is very important for me here in Florida is that I develop a trust with the audience. That they think, I don't know this composer, but if Michael has chosen this, I bet it's going to be interesting.
So when you got the feedback from folks here in the Bay Area, did you hear things like, hey, here in Tampa, they love Brahms, but lay off the Baroque? I mean, what sort of advice did you get about the Bay Area?
I'll give you an interesting example. So I came to do a coffee concert in May of 2013 or 14. And it's sort of like my second audition effectively here. And traditionally the coffee concert was smaller pieces of certain pieces and it kind of almost like spoon-feeding classical music to a certain extent in a very healthy and good way. But I said, I'm not doing that. We're going to do a piece by an arrangement of Purcell by a modern American composer, and we're going to do a piece by Panufnik called Sinfonia Sacra, followed by Beethoven 5, and it's going to be a journey from darkness to light. And I think it's fair to say the artistic administration were a little nervous of this, but I went out and I communicated to the audience, who are it's probably our most aged audience, and they were worried about whether they would appreciate this slightly more modern music. When I said to them, it's not about the tonal language, it's about the human story behind it. So I expressed this to them, and the piece that got the wildest standing ovation was the Panufnik, the Sinfonia Sacra. Because everybody understood the sense of isolation, everyone understood the human drama. They got the story behind Panufnik's. He left his country, he had a great longing for his homeland, he had pain, he had loss. Well, everyone's experienced that in their life. So if you can communicate behind the piece what's going on, people can cope with anything atonal. For example, when we listen to films, so often we're listening to wildly atonal music, but because it's related to the narrative, we don't find it distressing.
Again, you can see the Florida Orchestra schedule at WUSFnews.org. Click on the Florida Matters link. We've also included a nice bio of Michael Francis. Maestro, it has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much, Carson.
And that is it for today's show. The conversation continues online. As I mentioned, you can find our show at WUSFnews.org. Our show is produced by Lottie Watts with help from Mary Shedden. Our engineer is Craig George. Florida Matters is a production of WUSF Public Media. I'm Carson Cooper. Thanks for listening.